Chapter 7 Continued. There was already a small queue for the tap in the corner of the field. Harry, Ron and Hermione joined it, right behind a pair of men who were having a heated argument. One of them was a very old wizard who was wearing a long, flowery nightgown. The other was clearly a ministry wizard. He was holding out a pair of pinstriped trousers and almost crying with exasperation.
"Just put them on, Archie, there's a good chap. You can't walk around like that. The muggle on the gate's already getting suspicious."
"I bought this in a muggle shop," said the old wizard stubbornly. "Muggles wear them."
"Muggle women wear them, Archie, not the men. They wear these," said the ministry wizard, and he brandished the pinstriped trousers. "I'm not putting them on," said old Archie in indignation. "I like a healthy breeze round my privates, thanks."
Hermione was overcome with such a strong fit of the giggles at this point that she had to duck out of the queue, and only returned when Archie had collected his water and moved away again. Walking more slowly now because of the weight of the water, they made their way back through the campsite. Here and there they saw more familiar faces, other Hogwarts students with their families. Oliver Wood, the old captain of Harry's house Quidditch team, who had just left Hogwarts, dragged Harry over to his parents' tent to introduce him, and told him excitedly that he had just been signed to the Puddlemere United reserve team. Next, they were hailed by Ernie Macmillan, a Hufflepuff fourth year, and a little further on they saw Cho Chang, a very pretty girl who played Seeker on the Ravenclaw team. She waved and smiled at Harry, who slopped quite a lot of water down his front as he waved back. More to stop Ron smirking than anything, Harry hurriedly pointed out a large group of teenagers whom he had never seen before. "Who do you reckon they are?" he said. "They don't go to Hogwarts, do they?" "'Spect they go to some foreign school," said Ron. "I know there are others. Never met anyone who went to one, though. Bill had a pen friend at a school in Brazil. This was years and years ago, and he wanted to go on an exchange trip, but Mum and Dad couldn't afford it. His pen friend got all offended when he said he wasn't going, and sent him a cursed hat. It made his ears shrivel up." Harry laughed, but didn't voice the amazement he felt at hearing about other wizarding schools. He supposed, now he saw representatives of so many nationalities in the campsite, that he had been stupid never to realise that Hogwarts couldn't be the only one. He glanced at Hermione, who looked utterly unsurprised by the information. No doubt she had run across the news about other wizarding schools in some book or other.
"You've been ages," said George, when they finally got back to the Weasleys' tents.
"Met a few people," said Ron, setting the water down. "You not got that fire started yet?"
"Dad's having fun with the matches," said Fred.
Mr. Weasley was having no success at all in lighting the fire, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Splintered matches littered the ground around him, but he looked as though he was having the time of his life. "Oops!" he said, as he managed to light a match, and promptly dropped it in surprise.
"Come here, Mr. Weasley," said Hermione kindly, taking the box from him and starting to show him how to do it properly.
At last they got the fire lit, though it was at least another hour before it was hot enough to cook anything. There was plenty to watch while they waited, however. Their tent seemed to be pitched right alongside a kind of thoroughfare to the pitch, and ministry members kept hurrying up and down it, greeting Mr. Weasley cordially as they passed. Mr. Weasley kept up a running commentary, mainly for Harry and Hermione's benefit. His own children knew too much about the ministry to be greatly interested.
"That was Cuthbert Mockridge, head of the Goblin Liaison Office. Here comes Gilbert Wimple. He's with the Committee on Experimental Charms. He's had those horns for a while now. Hello, Arnie. Arnold Peasgood. He's an Obliviator, member of the Accidental Magic Reversal Squad, you know. And that's Bode and Croker. They're Unspeakables."
"They're what?"
"From the Department of Mysteries. Top secret. No idea what they get up to."
At last the fire was ready, and they had just started cooking eggs and sausages when Bill, Charlie and Percy came strolling out of the woods towards them.
"Just apparated, Dad," said Percy loudly.
"Ah, excellent. Lunch."
They were halfway through their plates of sausages and eggs when Mr. Weasley jumped to his feet, waving and grinning at a man who was striding towards them. "Aha!" he said. "The man of the moment, Ludo." Ludo Bagman was easily the most noticeable person Harry had seen so far, even including old Archie in his flowered nightdress. He was wearing long Quidditch robes in thick horizontal strips of bright yellow and black. An enormous picture of a wasp was splashed across his chest. He had the look of a powerfully built man gone slightly to seed. The robes were stretched tightly across a large belly he surely had not had in the days when he had played Quidditch for England. His nose was squashed, probably broken by a stray bludger, Harry thought, but his round blue eyes, short blonde hair, and rosy complexion made him look like a very overgrown schoolboy.
"Ahoy there!" Bagman called happily.
He was walking as though he had springs attached to the balls of his feet, and was plainly in a state of wild excitement.
"Arthur, old man!" he puffed as he reached the campfire. "What a day, eh? What a day! Could we have asked for more perfect weather? A cloudless night coming, and hardly a hiccup in the arrangements. Not much for me to do!"
Behind him, a group of haggard-looking ministry wizards rushed past, pointing at the distant evidence of some sort of a magical fire which was sending violet sparks 20 feet into the air. Percy hurried forwards with his hand outstretched. Apparently his disapproval of the way Ludo Bagman ran his department did not prevent him wanting to make a good impression.
"Ah, yes," said Mr. Weasley, grinning. "This is my son, Percy. He's just started in the ministry. And this is George, sorry, that's Fred. Bill, Charlie, Ron, my daughter Ginny, and Ron's friends Hermione Granger and Harry Potter."
Bagman did the smallest of double-takes when he heard Harry's name, and his eyes performed the familiar flick upwards to the scar on Harry's forehead.
"Everyone," Mr. Weasley continued, "this is Ludo Bagman. You know who he is. It's thanks to him we've got such good tickets."
Bagman beamed and waved his hand as if to say it had been nothing.
"Fancy a flutter on the match, Arthur,"
he said eagerly, jingling what seemed to be a large amount of gold in the pockets of his yellow and black robes.
"I've already got Roddy Pontner betting me Bulgaria will score first. I offered him nice odds, considering Ireland's front three are the strongest I've seen in years, and little Agatha Timms has put up half shares in her eel farm on a week-long match." "Oh, go on, then," said Mr. Weasley. "Let's see, a galleon on Ireland to win?"
"A galleon?"
Ludo Bagman looked slightly disappointed, but recovered himself.
"Very well, very well. Any other takers?"
"They're a bit young to be gambling," said Mr. Weasley. "Molly wouldn't like—"
"We'll bet 37 galleons, 15 sickles, 3 knuts," said Fred,
as he and George quickly pooled all their money,
"that Ireland win, but Victor Crumb gets the snitch. Oh, and we'll throw in a fake wand."
"You don't want to go showing Mr. Bagman rubbish like that," Percy hissed.
But Bagman didn't seem to think the wand was rubbish at all. On the contrary, his boyish face shone with excitement as he took it from Fred, and when the wand gave a loud squawk and turned into a rubber chicken, Bagman roared with laughter.
"Excellent! I haven't seen one that convincing in years. I'd pay 5 galleons for that."
Percy froze in an attitude of stunned disapproval.
"Boys," said Mr. Weasley under his breath, "I don't want you betting. That's all your savings. Your mother—"
"Don't be a spoilsport, Arthur,"
boomed Ludo Bagman, rattling his pockets excitedly.
"They're old enough to know what they want. You reckon Ireland will win, but Crumb'll get the snitch? Not a chance, boys, not a chance. I'll give you excellent odds on that one. We'll add 5 galleons for the funny one, then, shall we?"
Mr. Weasley looked on helplessly as Ludo Bagman whipped out a notebook and quill and began jotting down the twins' names.
"Cheers," said George, taking the slip of parchment Bagman handed him and tucking it away into the front of his robes.
Bagman turned most cheerfully back to Mr. Weasley.
"Couldn't do me a brew, I suppose. I'm keeping an eye out for Barty Crouch. My Bulgarian opposite number's making difficulties, and I can't understand a word he's saying. Barty'll be able to sort it out. He speaks about 150 languages.
"Mr. Crouch?"
said Percy, suddenly abandoning his look of poker-stiff disapproval and positively writhing with excitement. "He speaks over 200. Mermish and gobbledygook and troll." "Anyone can speak troll," said Fred dismissively. "All you have to do is point and grunt." Percy threw Fred an extremely nasty look and stoked the fire vigorously to bring the kettle back to the boil.
"Any news of Bertha Jorkins yet, Ludo?"
Mr. Weasley asked, as Bagman settled himself down on the grass beside them all.
"Not a dicky bird," said Bagman comfortably. "But she'll turn up. Poor old Bertha. Memory like a leaky cauldron and no sense of direction. Lost, you take my word for it. She'll wander back into the office sometime in October, thinking it's still July."
"You don't think it might be time to send someone to look for her?"
Mr. Weasley suggested tentatively, as Percy handed Bagman his tea.
"Barty Crouch keeps saying that,"
said Bagman, his round eyes widening innocently.
"But we really can't spare anyone at the moment. Oh, talk of the devil, Barty!"
A wizard had just apparated at their fireside, and he could not have made more of a contrast with Ludo Bagman, sprawled on the grass in his old wasp robes. Barty Crouch was a stiff, upright, elderly man, dressed in an impeccably crisp suit and tie. The parting in his short grey hair was almost unnaturally straight, and his narrow toothbrush moustache looked as though he trimmed it using a slide rule. His shoes were very highly polished. Harry could see at once why Percy idolised him. Percy was a great believer in rigidly following rules, and Mr. Crouch had complied with the rule about muggle dressing so thoroughly that he could have passed as a bank manager. Harry doubted even Uncle Vernon would have spotted him for what he really was.
"Pull up a bit of grass, Barty,"
said Ludo brightly, patting the ground beside him.
"No, thank you, Ludo,"
said Crouch, and there was a bite of impatience in his voice.
"I've been looking for you everywhere. The Bulgarians are insisting we add another 12 seats to the top box."
"Oh, is that what they're after?"
said Bagman.
"I thought the chap was asking to borrow a pair of tweezers. Bit of a strong accent."
"Mr. Crouch,"
said Percy breathlessly, sunk into a kind of half bow which made him look like a hunchback, "would you like a cup of tea?"
"Oh,"
said Mr. Crouch, looking over at Percy in mild surprise.
"Yes, thank you, Weatherby."
Fred and George choked into their own cups. Percy, very pink around the ears, busied himself with the kettle.
"Oh, and I've been wanting a word with you too, Arthur,"
said Mr. Crouch, his sharp eyes falling upon Mr. Weasley.
"Ali Bashir's on the warpath. He wants a word with you about your embargo on flying carpets."
Mr. Weasley heaved a deep sigh.
"I sent him an owl about that just last week. If I've told him once, I've told him 100 times. Carpets are defined as a muggle artifact by the Registry of Proscribed Charmable Objects, but will he listen?"
"I doubt it," said Mr. Crouch, accepting a cup from Percy. "He's desperate to export here."
"Well, they'll never replace brooms in Britain, will they?"
said Bagman.
"Ali thinks there's a niche in the market for a family vehicle," said Mr. Crouch. "I remember my grandfather had an Axminster that could seat 12, but that was before carpets were banned, of course."
He spoke as though he wanted to leave nobody in any doubt that all his ancestors had abided strictly by the law.
"So, been keeping busy, Barty?"
said Bagman, breezily.
"Fairly," said Mr. Crouch, dryly. "Organising portkeys across 5 continents is no mean feat, Ludo."
"I expect you'll both be glad when this is over,"
said Mr. Weasley.
Ludo Bagman looked shocked. "Glad? Dunno when I've had more fun. Still, it's not as though we haven't got anything to look forward to, eh, Barty? Eh? Plenty left to organise, eh?"
Mr. Crouch raised his eyebrows at Bagman.
"We agreed not to make the announcement until all the details..."
"Oh, details,"
said Bagman, waving the word away like a cloud of midges.
"They've signed, haven't they? They've agreed, haven't they? I bet you anything these kids will know soon enough anyway. I mean, it's happening at Hogwarts."
"Ludo, we need to meet the Bulgarians, you know,"
said Mr. Crouch sharply, cutting Bagman's remarks short. "Thank you for the tea, Weatherby." He pushed his undrunk tea back at Percy and waited for Ludo to rise. Bagman struggled to his feet again, swigging down the last of his tea, the gold in his pockets chinking merrily.
"See you all later," he said. "You'll be up in the top box with me. I'm commentating."
He waved. Barty Crouch nodded curtly, and both of them disapparated.
"What's happening at Hogwarts, Dad?" said Fred at once. "What were they talking about?"
"You'll find out soon enough," said Mr. Weasley, smiling. "It's classified information until such time as the Ministry decides to release it," said Percy stiffly. "Mr. Crouch was quite right not to disclose it."
"Oh, shut up, Weatherby," said Fred. A sense of excitement rose like a palpable cloud over the campsite as the afternoon wore on. By dusk, the still summer air itself seemed to be quivering with anticipation, and as darkness spread like a curtain over the thousands of waiting wizards, the last vestiges of pretense disappeared. The Ministry seemed to have bowed to the inevitable, and stopped fighting the signs of blatant magic now breaking out everywhere. Salesmen were apparating every few feet, carrying trays and pushing carts full of extraordinary merchandise. There were luminous rosettes, green for Ireland, red for Bulgaria, which were squealing the names of the players. Pointed green hats, bedecked with dancing shamrocks. Bulgarian scarves adorned with lions that really roared. Flags from both countries, which played their national anthems as they were waved. There were tiny models of firebolts, which really flew, and collectible figures of famous players, which strolled across the palm of your hand, preening themselves. "Been saving my pocket money all summer for this," Ron told Harry, as they and Hermione strolled through the salesman, buying souvenirs. Though Ron purchased himself a dancing shamrock hat and a large green rosette, he also bought a small figure of Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker. The miniature Crumb walked backwards and forwards over Ron's hand, scowling up at the green rosette above him.
"Wow, look at these," said Harry, hurrying over to a cart piled high with what looked like brass binoculars, except that they were covered in all sorts of weird knobs and dials.
"Omnioculars," said the sales wizard eagerly. "You can replay action, slow everything down, and they flash up a play-by-play breakdown if you need it. Bargain, 10 galleons each."
"Wish I hadn't bought this now," said Ron, gesturing at his dancing shamrock hat and gazing longingly at the omnioculars.
3 pairs, said Harry firmly to the wizard.
"No, don't bother,"
said Ron, going red. He was always touchy about the fact that Harry, who had inherited a small fortune from his parents, had much more money than he did.
"You won't be getting anything for Christmas," Harry told him, thrusting omnioculars into his and Hermione's hands. "For about 10 years, mind."
"Fair enough," said Ron, grinning.
"Oh, thanks, Harry," said Hermione. "And I'll get us some programmes. Look!"
Their money bags considerably lighter, they went back to the tents. Bill, Charlie and Ginny were all sporting green rosettes too, and Mr. Weasley was carrying an Irish flag. Fred and George had no souvenirs, as they had given Bagman all their gold. And then a deep, booming gong sounded somewhere beyond the woods, and at once green and red lanterns blazed into life in the trees, lighting a path to the pitch.
"It's time," said Mr. Weasley, looking as excited as any of them. "Come on, let's go."
Chapter 8. The Quidditch World Cup. Clutching their purchases, Mr. Weasley in the lead, they all hurried into the wood, following the lantern-lit trail. They could hear the sounds of thousands of people moving around them, shouts and laughter, snatches of singing. The atmosphere of feverish excitement was highly infectious. Harry couldn't stop grinning. They walked through the wood for 20 minutes, talking and joking loudly, until at last they emerged on the other side and found themselves in the shadow of a gigantic stadium. Though Harry could see only a fraction of the immense gold walls surrounding the pitch, he could tell that 10 cathedrals would fit comfortably inside it. "Seats 100,000, said Mr. Weasley, spotting the awe-struck look on Harry's face. "Ministry task force of 500 have been working on it all year. Muggle repelling charms on every inch of it. Every time Muggles have got anywhere near here all year, they've suddenly remembered urgent appointments and had to dash away again. Bless them," he added fondly, leading the way towards the nearest entrance, which was already surrounded by a swarm of shouting witches and wizards.
"Prime seats," said the Ministry witch at the entrance, when she checked their tickets. "Top box, straight upstairs, Arthur, and as high as you can go."
The stairs into the stadium were carpeted in rich purple. They clambered upwards with the rest of the crowd, which slowly filtered away through doors into the stands to their left and right. Mr. Weasley's party kept climbing, and at last they reached the top of the staircase and found themselves in a small box set at the highest point of the stadium and situated exactly halfway between the golden goalposts. About 20 purple and gilt chairs stood in two rows here, and Harry, filing into the front seats with the Weasleys, looked down upon a scene the like of which he could never have imagined. 100,000 witches and wizards were taking their places in the seats which rose in levels around the long, oval pitch. Everything was suffused with a mysterious golden light that seemed to come from the stadium itself. The pitch looked smooth as velvet from their lofty position. At either end of the pitch stood three goal hoops, 50 feet high. Right opposite them, almost at Harry's eye level, was a gigantic blackboard. Gold writing kept dashing across it as though an invisible giant's hand was scrawling upon it and then wiping it off again. Watching it, Harry saw that it was flashing advertisements across the pitch.
"The Blue Bottle. A broom for all the family. Safe, reliable, and with inbuilt anti-burglar buzzer. Mrs. Scour's all-purpose magical mess remover. No pain, no stain. Glad Rags Wizard Wear. London, Paris, Hogsmeade."
Harry tore his eyes away from the sign and looked over his shoulder to see who else was sharing the box with them. So far, it was empty, except for a tiny creature sitting in the second from last seat at the end of the row behind them. The creature, whose legs were so short they stuck out in front of it on the chair, was wearing a tea towel draped like a toga, and it had its face hidden in its hands. Yet those long, bat-like ears were oddly familiar.
"Dobby," said Harry incredulously.
The tiny creature looked up and parted its fingers, revealing enormous brown eyes and a nose the exact size and shape of a large tomato. It wasn't Dobby. It was, however, unmistakably a house elf, as Harry's friend Dobby had been. Harry had set Dobby free from his old owners, the Malfoy family.
"Did Sir just call me Dobby?"
squeaked the elf curiously from between its fingers. Its voice was higher even than Dobby's had been, a teeny, quivering squeak of a voice, and Harry suspected, though it was very hard to tell with a house elf, that this one might just be female. Ron and Hermione spun around in their seats to look. Though they had heard a lot about Dobby from Harry, they had never actually met him. Even Mr. Weasley looked around in interest. "Sorry," Harry told the elf, "I just thought you were someone I knew."
"But I knows Dobby too, sir,"
squeaked the elf. She was shielding her face, as though blinded by light, though the top box was not brightly lit.
"My name is Winky, sir, and you, sir."
Her dark brown eyes widened to the size of side plates as they rested upon Harry's scar.
"You is surely Harry Potter."
"Yeah, I am," said Harry.
"But Dobby talks of you all the time, sir,"
she said, lowering her hands very slightly and looking awestruck. "How is he?" said Harry. "How's freedom suiting him?"
"Ah, sir,"
said Winky, shaking her head.
"Ah, sir, meaning no disrespect, sir, but I is not sure you did Dobby a favour, sir, when you is setting him free."
"Why?" said Harry, taken aback. "What's wrong with him?"
"Freedom is going to Dobby's head, sir," said Winky sadly. ideas above his station, sir. Can't get another position, sir.
Why not? Said Harry.
Winky lowered her voice by a half octave and whispered,
He is wanting paying for his work, sir.
Paying? Said Harry blankly. Well, why shouldn't he be paid?
Winky looked quite horrified at the idea, and closed her fingers slightly, so that her face was half hidden again.
"House elves is not paid, sir,"
she said in a muffled squeak.
"No, no, no. I says to Dobby, I says, go find yourself a nice family and settle down, Dobby. He is getting up to all sorts of high jinks, sir, what is unbecoming to a house elf. You goes racketing around like this, Dobby, I says, and next thing I hear, you's up in front of the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures, like some common goblin.
Well, it's about time he had a bit of fun, said Harry.
House elves is not supposed to have fun, Harry Potter,
said Winky firmly from behind her hands.
House elves does what they is told. I is not liking heights at all, Harry Potter.
She glanced towards the edge of the box and gulped.
But my master sends me to the top box, and I come, sir.
Why has he sent you up here, if he knows you don't like heights? Said Harry, frowning.
Master wants me to save him a seat, Harry Potter. He is very busy,
said Winky, tilting her head towards the empty space beside her.
Winky is wishing she is back in Master's tent, Harry Potter, but Winky does what she is told. Winky is a good house elf.
She gave the edge of the box another frightened look, and hid her eyes completely again. Harry turned back to the others.
"So that's a house elf," Ron muttered. "Weird things, aren't they?"
"Dobby was weirder," said Harry fervently. Ron pulled out his omnioculars and started testing them, staring down into the crowd on the other side of the stadium.
"Wild," he said, twiddling the replay knob on the side. I can make that old bloke down there pick his nose again, and again, and again.
Hermione, meanwhile, was skimming eagerly through her velvet-covered, tasselled programme. A display from the team mascots will precede the match, she read aloud.
Oh, that's always worth watching, said Mr. Weasley. National teams bring creatures from their native land, you know, to put on a bit of a show.
The box filled gradually around them over the next half hour. Mr. Weasley kept shaking hands with people who were obviously very important wizards. Percy jumped to his feet so often that he looked as though he was trying to sit on a hedgehog. When Cornelius Fudge, the Minister for Magic himself, arrived, Percy bowed so low that his glasses fell off and shattered. Highly embarrassed, he repaired them with his wand, and thereafter remained in his seat, throwing jealous looks at Harry, whom Cornelius Fudge had greeted like an old friend. They had met before, and Fudge shook Harry's hand in fatherly fashion, asked how he was, and introduced him to the wizards on either side of him.
"Harry Potter, you know,"
he loudly told the Bulgarian minister, who was wearing splendid robes of black velvet trimmed with gold, and didn't seem to understand a word of English.
"Harry Potter! Oh, come on now, you know who he is. The boy who survived you-know-who. You do know who he is."
The Bulgarian wizard suddenly spotted Harry's scar and started gabbling loudly and excitedly, pointing at it.
"Knew we'd get there in the end," said Fudge wearily to Harry. "I'm no great shakes at languages. I need Barty Crouch for this sort of thing. Ah, I see his house elves saving him a seat. Good job, too. These Bulgarian blighters have been trying to catch all the best places. Ah, and here's Lucius."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione turned quickly. Edging along the second row to three still empty seats right behind Mr. Weasley were none other than Dobby the House Elf's old owners, Lucius Malfoy, his son Draco, and a woman Harry supposed must be Draco's mother. Harry and Draco Malfoy had been enemies ever since their very first journey to Hogwarts. A pale boy with a pointed face and white blonde hair, Draco greatly resembled his father. His mother was blonde, too. Tall and slim, she would have been nice-looking if she hadn't been wearing a look that suggested there was a nasty smell under her nose.
"Ah, Fudge," said Mr. Malfoy, holding out his hand as he reached the Minister for Magic. "How are you?
I don't think you've met my wife, Narcissa, or our son, Draco.
How do you do? How do you do? Said Fudge, smiling and bowing to Mrs. Malfoy. And allow me to introduce you to Mr. Blansk, or Obolonsk. Mr. Well, he's the Bulgarian Minister for Magic, and he can't understand a word I'm saying anyway, so never mind. And let's see who else. You know Arthur Weasley, I dare say?
It was a tense moment. Mr. Weasley and Mr. Malfoy looked at each other, and Harry vividly recalled the last time that they had come face to face. It had been in Flourish and Blot's bookshop, and they had had a fight. Mr. Malfoy's cold grey eyes swept over Mr. Weasley, and then up and down the row.
"Good Lord, Arthur," he said softly. "What did you have to sell to get seats in the top box? Surely your house wouldn't have fetched this much."
Fudge, who wasn't listening, said, "Lucius has just given a very generous contribution to St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries, Arthur. He's here as my guest."
"How nice," said Mr. Weasley, with a very strained smile.
Mr. Malfoy's eyes had returned to Hermione, who went slightly pink, but stared determinedly back at him. Harry knew exactly what was making Mr. Malfoy's lip curl. The Malfoys prided themselves on being purebloods. In other words, they considered anyone of Muggle descent, like Hermione, second class. However, under the gaze of the Minister for Magic, Mr. Malfoy didn't dare say anything. He nodded sneeringly to Mr. Weasley and continued down the line to his seats. Draco shot Harry, Ron, and Hermione one contemptuous look, then settled himself between his mother and father.
"Slimy gits," Ron muttered, as he, Harry, and Hermione turned to face the picture again. Next moment, Ludo Bagman had charged into the box.
"Everyone ready?"
he said, his round face gleaming like a great excited Edam.
"Minister, ready to go?"
"Ready when you are, Ludo," said Fudge comfortably.
Ludo whipped out his wand, directed it at his own throat, and said, "Sonorous!" and then spoke over the roar of sound that was now filling the packed stadium. His voice echoed over them, booming into every corner of the stands.
"Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome to the final of the 422nd Quidditch World Cup."
The spectators screamed and clapped. Thousands of flags waved, adding their discordant national anthems to the racket. The huge blackboard opposite them was wiped clear of its last message, "Bertie Bott's Every Flavour Beans, a risk with every mouthful," and now showed Bulgaria 0, Ireland 0.
"And now, without further ado, allow me to introduce the Bulgarian team mascots."
The right-hand side of the stands, which was a solid block of scarlet, roared its approval.
"I wonder what they've brought," said Mr. Weasley, leaning forwards in his seat.
"Ah!" He suddenly whipped off his glasses and polished them hurriedly on his robes. "Vila!"
What a veal! But 100 vila were now gliding out onto the pitch,
and Harry's question was answered for him. Vila were women, the most beautiful women Harry had ever seen, except that they weren't, they couldn't be, human. This puzzled Harry for a moment, while he tried to guess what exactly they could be. What could make their skin shine moon-bright like that, or their white-gold hair fan out behind them without wind? But then the music started, and Harry stopped worrying about them not being human. In fact, he stopped worrying about anything at all. The Vila had started to dance, and Harry's mind had gone completely and blissfully blank. All that mattered in the world was that he kept watching the Vila, because if they stopped dancing, terrible things would happen. And as the Vila danced faster and faster, wild, half-formed thoughts started chasing through Harry's dazed mind. He wanted to do something very impressive right now. Jumping from the box into the stadium seemed a good idea, but would it be good enough?
"Harry, what are you doing?"
said Hermione's voice from a long way off. The music stopped. Harry blinked. He was standing up, and one of his legs was resting on the wall of the box. Next to him, Ron was frozen in an attitude that looked as though he was about to dive from a springboard. Angry yells were filling the stadium. The crowd didn't want the Vila to go. Harry was with them. He would, of course, be supporting Bulgaria, and he wondered vaguely why he had a large green shamrock pinned to his chest. Ron, meanwhile, was absent-mindedly shredding the shamrocks on his hat. Mr. Weasley, smiling slightly, leant over to Ron and tugged the hat out of his hands. "You'll be wanting that," he said, "once Ireland have had their say." "Huh?" said Ron, staring open-mouthed at the Vila, who had now lined up along one side of the pitch. Hermione made a loud, tutting noise. She reached up and pulled Harry back into his seat. "Honestly," she said.
"And now," roared Ludo Bagman's voice, "kindly put your wands in the air for the Irish national team mascots."
Next moment, what seemed to be a great green and gold comet had come zooming into the stadium. It did one circuit of the stadium, then split into two smaller comets, each hurtling towards the goalposts. A rainbow arced suddenly across the pitch, connecting the two balls of light. The crowd oohed and ahed as though at a firework display. Now the rainbow faded, and the balls of light reunited and merged. They had formed a great, shimmering shamrock, which rose up into the sky and began to soar over the stands. Something like golden rain seemed to be falling from it. "Excellent!" yelled Ron, as the shamrock soared over their heads, and heavy gold coins rained from it, bouncing off their heads and seats. Squinting up at the shamrock, Harry realized that it was actually composed of thousands of tiny little bearded men with red waistcoats, each carrying a minute lamp of gold or green.
"Leprechauns!"
said Mr. Weasley, over the tumultuous applause of the crowd, many of whom were still fighting and rummaging around under their chairs to retrieve the gold. "There you go!" Ron yelled happily, stuffing a fistful of gold coins into Harry's hand. "For the omnioculars! Now you've got to buy me a Christmas present! Ha!" The great shamrock dissolved. The leprechauns drifted down onto the pitch on the opposite side from the Vila and settled themselves cross-legged to watch the match.
"And now, ladies and gentlemen, kindly welcome the Bulgarian national Quidditch team. I give you Dimitrov."
A scarlet-clad figure on a broomstick, moving so fast it was blurred, shot out onto the pitch from an entrance far below to wild applause from the Bulgarian supporters.
"Ivanova!"
A second scarlet-robed player zoomed out.
"Zograf! Levski! Volchanov! Volkov! And... Krumb!"
"That's him! That's him!" yelled Ron, following Krumb with his omnioculars. Harry quickly focused his own. Victor Krumb was thin, dark and sallow-skinned, with a large curved nose and thick black eyebrows. He looked like an overgrown bird of prey. It was hard to believe he was only 18.
"And now, please greet the Irish national Quidditch team," yelled Bagman, "presenting Connolly, Ryan, Troy, Mullet, Moran, Quigley, and Lynch."
Seven green blurs swept onto the pitch. Harry spun a small dial on the side of his omnioculars and slowed the players down enough to read the word Firebolt on each of their brooms and see their names embroidered in silver upon their backs.
"And here, all the way from Egypt, our referee, acclaimed chair wizard of the International Association of Quidditch, Hassan Mustafa."
A small and skinny wizard, completely bald but with a moustache to rival Uncle Vernon's, wearing robes of pure gold to match the stadium, strode out onto the pitch. A silver whistle was protruding from under the moustache, and he was carrying a large wooden crate under one arm, his broomstick under the other. Harry spun the speed dial on his omnioculars back to normal, watching closely as Mustafa mounted his broomstick and kicked the crate open. Four balls burst into the air. The scarlet quaffle, the two black bludgers, and, Harry saw it for the briefest moment before it sped out of sight, the minuscule winged golden snitch. With a sharp blast on his whistle, Mustafa shot into the air after the balls.
"They're off!" screamed Bagman. "And it's Mullich, Troy, Moran, Dimitrov, back to Mullich, Troy, Nevsky, Moran!"
It was Quidditch as Harry had never seen it played before. He was pressing his omnioculars so hard to his eyes that his glasses were cutting into the bridge of his nose. The speed of the players was incredible. The chasers were throwing the quaffle to each other so fast that Bagman only had time to say their names. Harry spun the slow dial on the right of his omnioculars again, pressed the play-by-play button on the top, and he was immediately watching in slow motion, while glittering purple lettering flashed across the lenses, and the noise of the crowd pounded against his eardrums. "Hawkshead attacking formation," he read, as he watched the three Irish chasers zoom closely together, Troy in the centre, slightly ahead of Mullet and Moran, bearing down upon the Bulgarians. Porskov ploy flashed up next, as Troy made as though to dart upwards with the quaffle, drawing away the Bulgarian chaser Ivanova and dropping the quaffle to Moran. One of the Bulgarian beaters, Volkov, swung hard at a passing bludger with his small club, knocking it into Moran's path. Moran ducked to avoid the bludger and dropped the quaffle, and Levski, soaring beneath, caught it.
"Troy scores!"
roared Bagman, and the stadium shuddered with a roar of applause and cheers.
10-0 to Ireland!"
"What?" Harry yelled, looking wildly around through his omnioculars. "But Levski's got the quaffle!" "Harry, if you're not going to watch at normal speed, you're going to miss things," shouted Hermione, who was dancing up and down, waving her arms in the air, while Troy did a lap of honour of the pitch. Harry looked quickly over the top of his omnioculars and saw that the leprechauns watching from the sidelines had all risen into the air again and formed the great glittering shamrock. Across the pitch, the Vila were watching them sulkily. Furious with himself, Harry spun his speed dial back to normal as play resumed. Harry knew enough about Quidditch to see that the Irish chasers were superb. They worked as a seamless team, appearing to read each other's minds by the way they positioned themselves, and the rosette on Harry's chest kept squeaking their names, "Troy, Mullet, Moran!" And within 10 minutes Ireland had scored twice more, bringing their lead to 30-0, and causing a thunderous tide of roars and applause from the green-clad supporters. The match became still faster but more brutal. Volkov and Volchanov, the Bulgarian beaters, were whacking the bludgers as fiercely as possible at the Irish chasers and were starting to prevent them using some of their best moves. Twice they were forced to scatter, and then, finally, Ivanova managed to break through their ranks, dodge the keeper, Ryan, and score Bulgaria's first goal.
"Fingers in your ears!"
bellowed Mr. Weasley, as the Vila started to dance in celebration. Harry screwed up his eyes, too. He wanted to keep his mind on the game. After a few seconds, he glanced at the pitch. The Vila had stopped dancing, and Bulgaria were again in possession of the quaffle.
"Dimitrov! Nevsky! Dimitrov! Ivanova! Oh, I say!"
roared Bagman. 100,000 wizards and witches gasped as the two seekers, Crum and Lynch, plummeted through the centre of the chasers so fast that it looked as though they had just jumped from aeroplanes without parachutes. Harry followed the descent through his omnioculars, squinting to see where the snitch was.
"They're going to crash!" screamed Hermione next to Harry.
She was half right. At the very last second, Victor Crum pulled out of the dive and spiralled off. Lynch, however, hit the ground with a dull thud that could be heard throughout the stadium. A huge groan rose from the Irish seats.
"Fool!" moaned Mr. Weasley. "Crum was fainting!" "It's time out!"
yelled Bagman's voice.
"As trained many wizards hurry on to the pitch to examine Aidan Lynch!"
"He'll be okay. He only got ploughed," Charlie said reassuringly to Ginny, who was hanging over the side of the box looking horror-struck. Which is what Crumb was after, of course. Harry hastily pressed the replay and play-by-play buttons on his omnioculars, twiddled the speed dial, and put them back up to his eyes. He watched as Crumb and Lynch dived again in slow motion. Vronsky faint, dangerous seeker diversion, read the shining purple lettering across his lenses. He saw Crumb's face contorted with concentration as he pulled out of the dive just in time while Lynch was flattened, and he understood. Crumb hadn't seen the snitch at all. He was just making Lynch copy him. Harry had never seen anyone fly like that. Crumb hardly looked as though he was using a broomstick at all. He moved so easily through the air that it looked as though he was unsupported and weightless. Harry turned his omnioculars back to normal and focused them on Crumb. He was circling high above Lynch, who was now being revived by medi-wizards with cups of potion. Harry, focusing still more closely upon Crumb's face, saw his dark eyes darting all over the ground 100 feet below. He was using the time while Lynch was revived to look for the snitch without interference. Lynch got to his feet at last, to loud cheers from the green-clad supporters, mounted his firebolt, and kicked back off into the air. His revival seemed to give Ireland new heart. When Mustafa blew his whistle again, the chasers moved into action with a skill unrivalled by anything Harry had seen so far. After 15 more fast and furious minutes, Ireland had pulled ahead by 10 more goals. They were now leading by 130 points to 10, and the game was starting to get dirtier. As Mullet shot towards the goalposts yet again, clutching the quaffle tightly under her arm, the Bulgarian keeper, Zograf, flew out to meet her. Whatever happened was over so quickly Harry didn't catch it, but a scream of rage from the Irish crowd and Mustafa's long, shrill whistle-blast told him it had been a foul. "And Mustafa takes the Bulgarian keeper to task for cobbing excessive use of elbows," Bagman informed the roaring spectators. "And, yes, it's a penalty to Ireland!" The leprechauns, who had risen angrily into the air like a swarm of glittering hornets when Mullet had been fouled, now darted together to form the words, "Ha, ha, ha." The Vila, on the other side of the pitch, leapt to their feet, tossed their hair angrily, and started to dance again. As one, the Weasley boys and Harry stuffed their fingers in their ears, but Hermione, who hadn't bothered, was soon tugging on Harry's arm. He turned to look at her, and she pulled his fingers impatiently out of his ears. "Look at the referee," she said, giggling. Harry looked down at the pitch. Hassan Mustafa had landed right in front of the dancing Vila and was acting very oddly indeed. He was flexing his muscles and smoothing his moustache excitedly.
"No, we can't have that," said Ludo Bagman,
though he sounded highly amused.
"Somebody slap the referee."
A medi-wizard came tearing across the pitch, his fingers stuffed in his own ears, and kicked Mustafa hard on the shins. Mustafa seemed to come to himself. Harry, watching through the omnioculars again, saw that he looked exceptionally embarrassed and was shouting at the Vila, who had stopped dancing and were looking mutinous.
"And unless I'm much mistaken, Mustafa is actually attempting to send off the Bulgarian team mascots," said Bagman's voice. "Now there's something we haven't seen before. All this could turn nasty."
It did. The Bulgarian beaters, Volkov and Volchanov, had landed either side of Mustafa and began arguing furiously with him, gesticulating towards the leprechauns, who had now gleefully formed the words, "He, he, he." Mustafa was not impressed by the Bulgarians' arguments, however. He was jabbing his finger into the air, clearly telling them to get flying again, and when they refused, he gave 2 short blasts on his whistle.
2 penalties for Ireland," shouted Bagman,
and the Bulgarian crowd howled with anger.
"And Volkov and Volchanov had better get back on those brooms. Yes, there they go, and Troy takes the quaffle."
Play had now reached a level of ferocity beyond anything they had yet seen. The beaters on both sides were acting without mercy. Volkov and Volchanov in particular seemed not to care whether their clubs made contact with bludger or human as they swung them violently through the air. Dimitrov shot straight at Moran, who had the quaffle, nearly knocking her off her broom.
"Foul!" roared the Irish supporters as one, all standing up in a great wave of green.
"Foul!" echoed Ludo Bagman's magically magnified voice. "Dimitrov skins Moran, deliberately flying to collide there, and it's got to be another penalty. Yes, there's the whistle."
The leprechauns had risen into the air again, and this time they formed a giant hand, which was making a very rude sign indeed across the pitch towards the Vila. At this, the Vila lost control. They launched themselves across the pitch and began throwing what seemed to be handfuls of fire at the leprechauns. Watching through his omnioculars, Harry saw that they didn't look remotely beautiful now. On the contrary, their faces were elongating into sharp, cruel-beaked bird heads, and long, scaly wings were bursting from their shoulders.
"And that, boys," yelled Mr. Weasley over the tumult of the crowd below, "is why you should never go for looks alone."
Ministry wizards were flooding onto the field to separate the Vila and the leprechauns, but with little success. Meanwhile, the pitched battle below was nothing to the one above. Harry turned this way and that, staring through his omnioculars as the quaffle changed hands with the speed of a bullet.
"Levski, Dimitrov, Moran, Troy, Mullet, even over, Moran again, Moran, Moran scores!"
But the cheers of the Irish supporters were barely heard over the shrieks of the Vila, the blasts now issuing from the ministry members' wands, and the furious roars of the Bulgarians. The game recommenced immediately. Now Levski had the quaffle, now Dimitrov. The Irish beater Quigley swung heavily at a passing bludger and hit it as hard as possible towards Crumb, who did not duck quickly enough. It hit him hard in the face. There was a deafening groan from the crowd. Crumb's nose looked broken. There was blood everywhere. But Hassan Mustafa didn't blow his whistle. He had become distracted, and Harry couldn't blame him. One of the Vila had thrown a handful of fire and set his broomtail alight. Harry wanted someone to realise that Crumb was injured, even though he was supporting Ireland. Crumb was the most exciting player on the pitch. Ron obviously felt the same.
"Time out! Oh, come on, he can't play like that. Look at him! Look at Lynch!"
Harry yelled. For the Irish seeker had suddenly gone into a dive, and Harry was quite sure that this was no Vronsky feint. This was the real thing.
"He's seen the snitch!" Harry shouted. "He's seen it! Look at him go!"
Half the crowd seemed to have realised what was happening. The Irish supporters rose in a great wave of green, screaming their seeker on, but Crumb was on his tail. How he could see where he was going, Harry had no idea. There were flecks of blood flying through the air behind him, but he was drawing level with Lynch now as the pair of them hurtled towards the ground again.
"They're going to crash!" shrieked Hermione.
"They're not!" roared Ron.
"Lynch's!" yelled Harry.
And he was right. For the second time, Lynch hit the ground with tremendous force and was immediately stampeded by a horde of angry Vila.
"The snitch! Where's the snitch?"
bellowed Charlie along the row.
"He's got it! Crumb's got it! It's all over!" shouted Harry.
Crumb, his red robes shining with blood from his nose, was rising gently into the air, his fist held high, a glint of gold in his hand. The scoreboard was flashing. Bulgaria 160, Ireland 170, across the crowd, who didn't seem to have realised what had happened. Then, slowly, as though a great jumbo jet was revving up, the rumbling from the Ireland supporters grew louder and louder and erupted into screams of delight.
"Ireland win!"
shouted Bagman, who, like the Irish, seemed to have been taken aback by the sudden end of the match.
"Crumb gets the snitch, but Ireland win! Good Lord, I don't think any of us were expecting that!"
"What did he catch the snitch for?"
Ron bellowed, even as he jumped up and down, applauding with his hands over his head.
"He ended it when Ireland were 160 points ahead, the idiot!"
"He knew they were never going to catch up!" Harry shouted back over all the noise, also applauding loudly.
"The Irish chasers were too good! He wanted to end it on his terms, that's all!"
"He was very brave, wasn't he?"
Hermione said, leaning forward to watch Crumb land, and the swarm of Mediwizards blasting a path through the battling leprechauns and Vila to get to him.
"He looks a terrible mess."
Harry put his omnioculars to his eyes again. It was hard to see what was happening below, because leprechauns were zooming delightedly all over the pitch, but he could just make out Crumb surrounded by mediwizards. He looked surlier than ever, and refused to let them mop him up. His teammates were around him, shaking their heads and looking dejected. A short way away, the Irish players were dancing gleefully in a shower of gold descending from their mascots. Flags were waving all over the stadium. The Irish national anthem blared from all sides. The Vila were shrinking back into their usual beautiful selves now, though looking dispirited and forlorn.
"Well, we fought bravely," said a gloomy voice behind Harry.
He looked around. It was the Bulgarian Minister for Magic.
"You can speak English," said Fudge, sounding outraged. "And you've been letting me mime everything all day."
"Well, it was very funny,"
said the Bulgarian Minister, shrugging.
And as the Irish team perform a lap of honour, flanked by their mascots, the Quidditch World Cup itself is brought into the top box, roared Bagman.
Harry's eyes were suddenly dazzled by a blinding white light as the top box was magically illuminated so that everyone in the stands could see the inside. Squinting towards the entrance, he saw two panting wizards carrying into the box a vast golden cup, which they handed to Cornelius Fudge, who was still looking very disgruntled that he'd been using sign language all day for nothing.
"Let's have a really loud hand for the gallant losers, Bulgaria!"
Bagman shouted, and up the stairs into the box came the seven defeated Bulgarian players. The crowd below were applauding appreciatively. Harry could see thousands and thousands of omniocular lenses flashing and winking in their direction. One by one, the Bulgarians filed between the rows of seats in the box, and Bagman called out the name of each as they shook hands with their own minister and then with Fudge. Crumb, who was last in line, looked a real mess. Two black eyes were blooming spectacularly on his bloody face. He was still holding the snitch. Harry noticed that he seemed much less coordinated on the ground. He was slightly duck-footed and distinctly round-shouldered. But when Crumb's name was announced, the whole stadium gave him a resounding, ear-splitting roar. And then came the Irish team. Aidan Lynch was being supported by Moran and Connolly. The second crash seemed to have dazed him, and his eyes looked strangely unfocused. But he grinned happily as Troy and Quigley lifted the cup into the air and the crowd below thundered their approval. Harry's hands were numb with clapping. At last, when the Irish team had left the box to perform another lap of honour on their brooms, Aidan Lynch on the back of Connolly's, clutching hard around his waist and still grinning in a bemused sort of way, Bagman pointed his wand at his throat and muttered,
"Quietus." "They'll be talking about this one for years," he said hoarsely. "A really unexpected twist, that. Shame it couldn't have lasted longer. Ah, yes, yes, I owe you... how much?"
For Fred and George had just scrambled over the backs of their seats and were standing in front of Ludo Bagman with broad grins on their faces, their hands outstretched. Chapter 9. The Dark Mark.
"Don't tell your mother you've been gambling," Mr. Weasley implored Fred and George as they all made their way slowly down the purple-carpeted stairs.
"Don't worry, Dad," said Fred gleefully. "We've got big plans for this money. We don't want it confiscated."
Mr. Weasley looked for a moment as though he was going to ask what these big plans were, but seemed to decide, upon reflection, that he didn't want to know. They were soon caught up in the crowds, now flooding out of the stadium and back to their campsites. Raucous singing was borne towards them on the night air as they retraced their steps along the lantern-lit path, and leprechauns kept shooting over their heads, cackling and waving their lanterns. When they finally reached the tents
Nobody felt like sleeping at all, and given the level of noise around them, Mr. Weasley agreed that they could all have one last cup of cocoa together before turning in. They were soon arguing enjoyably about the match. Mr. Weasley got drawn into a disagreement about cobbing with Charlie, and it was only when Ginny fell asleep right at the tiny table and spilled hot chocolate all over the floor that Mr. Weasley called a halt to the verbal replays and insisted that everyone went to bed. Hermione and Ginny went into the next tent, and Harry and the rest of the Weasleys changed into pyjamas and clambered into their bunks. From the other side of the campsite, they could still hear much singing and the odd echoing bang. "Oh, I am glad I'm not on duty," muttered Mr. Weasley sleepily. "I wouldn't fancy having to go and tell the Irish they've got to stop celebrating." Harry, who was on a top bunk above Ron, lay staring up at the canvas ceiling of the tent, watching the glow of an occasional leprechaun lantern flying overhead, and picturing again some of Crumb's more spectacular moves. He was itching to get back on his own firebolt and try out the Vronsky feint. Somehow Oliver Wood had never managed to convey with all his wriggling diagrams what that move was supposed to look like. Harry saw himself in robes that had his name on the back and imagined the sensation of hearing a 100,000-strong crowd roar as Ludo Bagman's voice echoed throughout the stadium, "I give you Potter!" Harry never knew whether he had actually dropped off to sleep or not. His fantasies of flying like Crumb might well have slipped into actual dreams. All he knew was that, quite suddenly, Mr. Weasley was shouting, "Get up! Ron! Harry! Come on now! Get up! This is urgent!" Harry sat up quickly and the top of his head hit canvas. "'S'matter?" he said. Dimly, he could tell that something was wrong. The noises in the campsite had changed. The singing had stopped. He could hear screams and the sound of people running. He slipped down from the bunk and reached for his clothes. But Mr. Weasley, who had pulled on his jeans over his own pyjamas, said, "No time, Harry. Just grab a jacket and get outside, quickly." Harry did as he was told and hurried out of the tent, Ron at his heels. By the light of the few fires that were still burning, he could see people running away into the woods, fleeing something that was moving across the field towards them, something that was emitting odd flashes of light and noises like gunfire. Loud jeering, roars of laughter, and drunken yells were drifting towards them. Then came a burst of strong green light which illuminated the scene. A crowd of wizards, tightly packed and moving together with wands pointing straight upwards, was marching slowly across the field. Harry squinted at them. They didn't seem to have faces. Then he realized that their heads were hooded and their faces masked. High above them, floating along in mid-air, four struggling figures were being contorted into grotesque shapes. It was as though the masked wizards on the ground were puppeteers, and the people above them were marionettes operated by invisible strings that rose from the wands into the air. Two of the figures were very small. More wizards were joining the marching group, laughing and pointing up at the floating bodies. Tents crumpled and fell as the marching crowd swelled. Once or twice, Harry saw one of the marchers blast a tent out of his way with his wand. Several caught fire. The screaming grew louder. The floating people were suddenly illuminated as they passed over a burning tent, and Harry recognized one of them, Mr. Roberts, the campsite manager. The other three looked as though they might be his wife and children. One of the marchers below flipped Mrs. Roberts upside down with his wand. Her nightdress fell down to reveal voluminous drawers. She struggled to cover herself up as the crowd below her screeched and hooted with glee. "That's sick," Ron muttered, watching the smallest muggle child, who had begun to spin like a top, 60 foot above the ground, his head flopping limply from side to side. "That is really sick." Hermione and Ginny came hurrying towards them, pulling coats over their nightdresses, with Mr. Weasley right behind them. At the same moment, Bill, Charlie and Percy emerged from the boys' tent, fully dressed, with their sleeves rolled up and their wands out. "We're going to help the ministry," Mr. Weasley shouted over all the noise, rolling up his own sleeves.
You lot, get into the woods and stick together. I'll come and fetch you when we've sorted this out."
Bill, Charlie and Percy were already sprinting away towards the oncoming marchers. Mr. Weasley tore after them. Ministry wizards were dashing from every direction towards the source of the trouble. The crowd beneath the Roberts family was coming ever closer.
"Come on,"
said Fred, grabbing Ginny's hand and starting to pull her towards the wood. Harry, Ron, Hermione and George followed. They all looked back as they reached the trees. The crowd beneath the Roberts family was larger than ever. They could see the ministry wizards trying to get through it to the hooded wizards in the centre, but they were having great difficulty. It looked as though they were scared to perform any spell that might make the Roberts family fall. The coloured lanterns that had lit the path to the stadium had been extinguished. Dark figures were blundering through the trees. Children were crying. Anxious shouts and panicked voices were reverberating around them in the cold night air. Harry felt himself being pushed hither and thither by people whose faces he could not see. Then he heard Ron yell with pain.
"What happened?"
said Hermione anxiously, stopping so abruptly that Harry walked into her.
"Ron, where are you? Oh, this is stupid. Lumos!"
She illuminated her wand and directed its narrow beam across the path. Ron was lying sprawled on the ground.
"Tripped over a tree root," he said angrily, getting to his feet again.
"Well, with feet that size, hard not to," said a drawling voice from behind them.
Harry, Ron and Hermione turned sharply. Draco Malfoy was standing alone nearby them, leaning against a tree, looking utterly relaxed. His arms folded, he seemed to have been watching the scene on the campsite through a gap in the trees. Ron told Malfoy to do something that Harry knew he would never have dared say in front of Mrs. Weasley.
"Language, Weasley," said Malfoy, his pale eyes glittering. "Hadn't you better be hurrying along now? You wouldn't like her spotted, would you?"
He nodded at Hermione, and at the same moment a blast like a bomb sounded from the campsite, and a flash of green light momentarily lit the trees around them.
"What's that supposed to mean?" said Hermione, defiantly.
"Granger, they're after muggles," said Malfoy. "Do you want to be showing off your knickers in mid-air? Because if you do hang around, they're moving this way, and it would give us all a laugh."
"Hermione's a witch!" Harry snarled.
"Have it your own way, Potter," said Malfoy, grinning maliciously. "If you think they can't spot a mudblood, stay where you are."
"You watch your mouth!" shouted Ron.
Everybody present knew that mudblood was a very offensive term for a witch or wizard of muggle parentage.
"Never mind, Ron," said Hermione quickly, seizing Ron's arm to restrain him as he took a step towards Malfoy.
There came a bang from the other side of the trees that was louder than anything they had heard. Several people nearby screamed.
Malfoy chuckled softly. "Scare easily, don't they?" he said lazily. "I suppose your daddy told you all to hide. What's he up to, trying to rescue the muggles?"
"Where are your parents?" said Harry, his temper rising. "Out there wearing masks, are they?"
Malfoy turned his face to Harry, still smiling.
"Well, if they were, I wouldn't be likely to tell you, would I, Potter?"
"Oh, come on," said Hermione, with a disgusted look at Malfoy. "Let's go and find the others."
"Keep that big bushy head down, Granger," sneered Malfoy.
"Come on," Hermione repeated, and she pulled Harry and Ron off up the path again. "I'll bet you anything his dad is one of that masked lot," said Ron hotly.
"Well, with any luck, the ministry will catch him," said Hermione fervently.
"Oh, I can't believe this. Where have the others got to?"
Fred, George and Ginny were nowhere to be seen, though the path was packed with plenty of other people, all of them looking nervously over their shoulders towards the commotion back at the campsite. A huddle of teenagers in pyjamas was arguing vociferously a little way along the path. When they saw Harry, Ron and Hermione, a girl with thick, curly hair turned and said quickly,
"Où est Madame Maxime? Nous l'avons perdue."
What? Said Ron.
"Oh."
The girl who had spoken turned her back on him, and as they walked on, they distinctly heard her say,
"Hogwarts."
"Beaubaton," muttered Hermione.
"'Sorry?' said Harry. "'They must go to Beaubaton,' said Hermione. "'You know, Beaubaton Academy of Magic. "'I read about it in An Appraisal of Magical Education in Europe.'
"'Oh, yeah, right,' said Harry.
"'Fred and George can't have gone that far,' said Ron, "'pulling out his wand, lighting it like Hermione, "'and squinting up the path. "'Harry dug in the pockets of his jacket for his own wand. "'But it wasn't there. "'The only things he could find were his omnioculars. "'Ah, no! I don't believe it! "'I've lost my wand!' "'You're kidding!' "'Ron and Hermione raised their wands high enough "'to spread the narrow beams of light further on the ground.' Harry looked all around him, but his wand was nowhere to be seen.
"'Maybe it's back in the tent,' said Ron. "'Maybe it fell out of your pocket when we were running,' Hermione suggested anxiously.
"'Yeah,' said Harry, "'maybe. "'He usually kept his wand with him at all times in the wizarding world, "'and finding himself without it in the midst of a scene like this "'made him feel very vulnerable. "'A rustling noise made all three of them jump.' Winky, the house elf, was fighting her way out of a clump of bushes nearby. She was moving in a most peculiar fashion, apparently with great difficulty. It was as though someone invisible was trying to hold her back.
"'There is bad wizards about!'
she squeaked distractedly as she leant forwards and laboured to keep running.
"'People high, high in the air! Winky is getting out of the way!'
and she disappeared into the trees on the other side of the path, panting and squeaking as she fought the force that was restraining her. "'What's up with her?' said Ron, looking curiously after Winky. "'Why can't she run properly?' "'Bet she didn't ask permission to hide,' said Harry. He was thinking of Dobby. Every time he had tried to do something the Malfoys wouldn't like, he had been forced to start beating himself up. "'You know, house elves get a very raw deal,' said Hermione indignantly. "'It's slavery, that's what it is. "'That Mr. Crouch made her go up to the top of the stadium, "'and she was terrified, and he's got her bewitched, "'so she can't even run when they start trampling tents. "'Why doesn't anyone do something about it?'
"'Well, the elves are happy, aren't they?' Ron said. "'You heard old Winky back at the match. "'House elves is not supposed to have fun. "'That's what she likes, being bossed around.'
"'It's people like you, Ron,' Hermione began hotly, "'who prop up rotten and unjust systems just because they're too lazy to—'
Another loud bang echoed from the edge of the wood.
"'Let's just keep moving, shall we?' said Ron, and Harry saw him glance edgily at Hermione. Perhaps there was truth in what Malfoy had said. Perhaps Hermione was in more danger than they were. They set off again, Harry is still searching his pockets, even though he knew his wand wasn't there. They followed the dark path deeper into the wood, still keeping an eye out for Fred, George and Ginny. They passed a group of goblins who were cackling over a sack of gold they had undoubtedly won betting on the match, and who seemed quite unperturbed by the trouble on the campsite. Further still along the path, they walked into a patch of silvery light, and when they looked through the trees, they saw three tall and beautiful vila standing in a clearing, surrounded by a gaggle of young wizards, all of whom were talking very loudly.
"'I pull down about 100 sacks of galleons a year,' one of them shouted. "'I'm a dragon killer for the Committee of the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures.' "'No, you're not,' yelled his friend. "'You're a dishwasher at the Leaky Cauldron, but I'm a vampire hunter. "'I've killed about 90 so far.'
A third young wizard, whose pimples were visible even by the dim, silvery light of the vila, now cut in.
"'I'm about to become the youngest ever minister for magic, I am!'
Harry snorted with laughter. He recognised the pimply wizard. His name was Stan Shunpike, and he was in fact a conductor on the triple-decker night bus. He turned to tell Ron this, but Ron's face had gone oddly slack. And the next second Ron was yelling,
"'Did I tell you I've invented a broomstick that'll reach Jupiter?'
"'Honestly,' said Hermione again, and she and Harry grabbed Ron firmly by the arms, wheeled him around, and marched him away. By the time the sounds of the vila and their admirers had faded completely, they were in the very heart of the wood. They seemed to be alone now. Everything was much quieter.